Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Welcome to Mormon Stories. I'm Andrew Ainsworth. Our guest today on Mormon Stories is going to be Phil McLemore. Phil is a longtime convert to the LDS Church. He served as a CES instructor for many years and also served as an LDS chaplain in the Air Force. Phil has had some very challenging experiences in life that caused him to reach out to Eastern spiritual traditions in search of relief. And not only did he find the relief there, but unexpectedly, what he found completely transformed his spirituality. This is what I hope to be the first in a series of podcasts here on Mormon Stories, where we interview Mormons who have incorporated Eastern spiritual traditions into their personal spiritual practice. In this case, the Eastern spiritual tradition that Phil settled on was the Hindu yogic tradition, and so he's going to be telling us about that. He's also going to be telling us about meditation and give us some how-tos and the purposes for meditation for those of you who are interested. And lastly, in the third and fourth segments of the podcast, he's going to be reviewing with us two of his excellent articles that he had published in Sunstone magazine, one of which is called Mormon Mantras and the other called The Yoga of Christ. And both of those excellent articles provide Phil's insights from Eastern spiritual practice on Western Christianity and Mormonism in particular. So I'm very excited to have Phil here today. Phil McLemore, welcome to Mormon Stories. I'd like to get started jumping in where we always do with our guests, which is just to have you give us a bit of your background. Why don't you tell us about, you know, where you were born and raised and your religious upbringing, any sort of foundational developments or events or experiences in your spiritual life, and why don't you take us up to about the point where you're 19 years old, around there.
Well, I was raised Catholic. I actually went to Catholic schools, attended an all-boy private Catholic school. Always assumed Catholicism was true. I can remember we had Mormons that lived across the street. This was back in the early 60s.
And where was this exactly? Where'd you grow up?
Started in Tampa, Florida, but by the time I got into high school, we were in Sacramento, California. Mm-hmm. And of course, in those days, Mormons got up early. The fathers got up early for priesthood meeting, came back, picked up the family for Sunday school, went to Sunday school, came back home. They went back later for a sacrament meeting. And of course, Relief Society and primary was during the week. And I just watched this Mormon family coming and going to church multiple times during the week. And I remember on a Sunday morning looking at the comics after we'd come home from Mass. And I said to my mother, boy, you know, this spirituality stuff is strange because, you know, we spend an hour, go to Mass, we're going to heaven. These poor Mormon folks across the street are running themselves ragged, going back and forth to church, and they're going to hell. And it just didn't seem quite... quite just.
Uh-huh.
But I found church boring, certainly for a 17-year-old. My father died when I was 7. My mother never remarried. She worked, and so I did spend quite a bit of time on my own. And she got mad at the priest at some point because of something that happened to my brother in school. So there was no real pressure from my mother to continue to go to church. I had started college. That was in 1968. And attending church just wasn't really part of the environment at that point.
Okay. So about what age would you say you kind of tapered off and stopped attending your Catholic services?
Oh, I stopped right when I graduated from high school at 17.
Okay. And did you... Prior to that, I mean, did you consider yourself a, a believer in Catholicism? Did you have spiritual experiences in a Catholic context that at least caused you to believe you had a testimony in the Catholic Church?
I just accepted it because I was raised that way. I don't remember any particular spiritual experiences. Certainly one of the things that drew me into Mormonism was a whole set and range of spiritual experiences that I hadn't had before. From 17 to 19, even though I didn't consider myself really a spiritual person, I was always interested in what people believed, what impact it had in their lives. And so I spent those 2 years really attending any church that a girlfriend I had was going to. I've probably been inside every church imaginable just in those 2 years with different friends. If there were tent meetings on the side of the road, I'd go in and have that experience of those charismatic tent meetings. So I had a pretty broad range of experience when I was finally introduced to the church. I had Jehovah's Witnesses come by and knock on the door and took their six-month Bible study. So by the time Mormonism came into my world, I had quite a variety of experiences.
And did you say that you were introduced to the LDS Church through a girlfriend?
It was through a girlfriend. It was a girlfriend that actually chose another, and that angered me somewhat, and I distanced myself from her, and she very patiently, over the course of a year, invited me to things. I never really followed up, and then one time her fiancé, this was during Vietnam, her fiancé had enlisted in the Air Force, was at training camp, and she called me and said she had a bunch of girls that needed a ride to an activity and wanted to know if I would help. And I thought, man, bunch of girls. if it doesn't work with her, maybe there's some other opportunities. Well, they were all Mormon girls. It was a Mormon family day at a picnic, and the missionaries were already prepared for ambush.
So when you showed up and dropped off the load of LDS girls, you got ambushed there by missionaries?
Well, they were better than that. They invited me for the festivities, so there were games and there was food. And then toward the end of the day, we're going to Cindy's house. The missionaries are going to be there, and that's what started it.
Okay. And so did you start taking the missionary discussions right away?
We started with discussion one that night.
Okay, and what caused you to continue with the discussions?
I was very impressed with the people. The families I met at the picnic were very impressive. The particular group of young adults that were a part of that were just some of the friendliest and kindest and nicest people I had known. And so it was really just the draw of nice people.
Uh-huh. And how long did it take for you to decide to join the LDS Church?
It wasn't easy. I went through the entire discussions. It was easy for me to comprehend the level of commitment. This wasn't an hour of Mass on Sunday. I could see this was lifestyle. I could see that this was going to impact every aspect of my life, and I wasn't quite sure I was willing to do that unless I...
Yeah.
Had some deeper conviction. So at the end of the first set of discussions, I just wasn't ready. So they asked me to invite a friend and take him again, which I did. And then after the second set of discussions, I still wasn't ready. So they asked me to invite another friend, and we went through the discussions again. And it was on the fifth discussion, third set, my friend was being very obstinate. He was a very bright person, and he was actually asking the missionaries a series of questions that were putting him in an intellectual trap, and I could see him falling into the trap. They didn't see it coming, but I'd already been through the fifth discussion a couple of times, so I just took over. I pushed the missionaries back. These were the flannel board days. I moved the flannel board figures around, retaught the discussion, and then... we just got to an impasse as to what we were agreeing or not agreeing to. And I just started saying to my friend, Bob, I don't understand why you can't see this. It's so clear. And then, I look around the room and everyone has all these goofy smiles. And I thought, oh, no.
I'm just curious, what's the topic of the fifth discussion in those days?
That was the plan of salvation.
Okay.
Pre-existence, spirit world, degrees of glory.
Okay, and that obviously sounds like something that really resonated with you.
It did. It made sense in a way that heaven and hell did not from before.
Yeah. Okay. And is that when you decided to be baptized? Was that pretty much the pivotal turning point?
That was the clincher. I didn't actually commit that night. I went and played basketball with the missionaries the next day. And the missionary that had taught me, his name was Hiram Johnson Smith III, or Hiram Smith Johnson III. And he challenged me to a game of 21, and he said, if I lost, I'd have to be baptized. If I won, I wouldn't have to be baptized. And he won by 1 point at the last second. So,
in fact, I think I heard a story about that. Someone said, who were those three big Indians guiding that ball into the basket for that last point?
Well, actually, I was ahead by 10 points, and and I thought, this is going to be awkward. And then he started heaving in these top of the key shots. So something was with him.
Excellent. Okay, and so you joined at what age then exactly was this? Was this at 19 years old?
I was a few months before 20.
Okay, and so that's prime mission age when young men usually leave for their missions. Did you serve a mission?
I did. The very next year, the bishop called me in, and it's a long story, but my name had come into his mind. He'd been fasting and praying about me. He told me the Lord wanted me to serve, and we had such a spiritual experience together. It was clearly seemed to be the right thing, so I accepted the call and went to Brazil.
Oh, wow. And how was your mission experience?
Boy, very complicated. I went to a mission that was one of the highest baptizing missions in the world. It's one of those South American nightmares. We had a president, the first president was determined to... Well, let me tell you this. We had 5,200 baptisms a year with 200 missionaries. It was a heavy salesman approach. There was tons of pressure. There's just many, many sad stories that are related to the mission. Surprisingly, being a member of the church just a year, it didn't take long to figure out this is not godly. And I actually rebelled against that whole system. I mean, we actually had a core of giant-sized missionaries that were dragging missionaries out of their beds in the middle of the night and threatening bodily harm if their zones didn't get X number of baptisms. So it was either that or rewards, leather jackets and other things that were given out. So it was pretty sad. Fortunately, my rebellion landed me in far out cities and little two missionary towns that where we couldn't be overly supervised. And in that context, I had wonderful experiences just teaching the gospel in a spiritual way and working with families that I loved and enjoyed. So.
And did you, and I neglected to ask you this when we were discussing your experiences with the missionaries, but would you say that your conversion to the LDS Church was, you already mentioned the social component, really admiring the young men and women that you were interacting with, and You know, you mentioned when you started teaching the fifth discussion to your friend how there was a logical appeal to you, that the idea of a pre-existence and mortal existence and an afterlife made more sense than just us, and degrees of glory made more sense than heaven and hell. So there's a logical appeal to you. But would you also say that there was a, was there any big spiritual conversion moment for you, or was it more a social, intellectual conversion?
The moment, several things. The moment was that night at the discussion when I started teaching my friend and saying to him, "Can't you see? Don't you understand?" It was obvious I was believing it at that point, and the theology seemed right to me. It was comprehensive. It was expansive. It seemed to be just. It was just a vision and a system of belief that made sense. And on top of that, the people I was being fellowshiped by were people who were living with integrity, whose religion was a part of their day-to-day lives. It wasn't an afterthought. It's who and what they were. So the integrity of that belief and living that out was very impressive to me. And I just came to a point where I thought, this is what I want and this is what I believe.
Okay. And so there's definitely a level of belief there. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is what the foundation of that belief was, simply because people believe for different reasons. For example, today I know that the typical missionary approach is to teach about the Godhead, teach about the Restoration, teach about the Book of Mormon, encourage someone to pray and hope that the Spirit will touch that person's heart and that they will receive some sort of spiritual witness or spiritual confirmation, some sort of experience with the divine that will give them a testimony. And I guess that's what I'm getting at is, do you feel like you ever had that experience either before joining the church or afterwards while you were on your mission?
What happened to me was the way I experienced Catholicism, it was very sterile. Mormonism was a very personal religion. Instead of praying to kind of an unknown God, I'm praying to my Heavenly Father. So my prayers began to feel more personal. I don't remember any dramatic sorts of any particular dramatic spiritual experience necessarily. But there was just an overall sense that I had entered into a relationship with God. He was aware of me. He was responding to me. He was guiding my life. And as a missionary, I did feel guided in my work. We did things that had the evidence of inspiration. I loved studying the gospel. I loved studying the scriptures and memorizing the scriptures. I read the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, Discourses of Brigham Young, Articles of Faith, Jesus the Christ. I read all of those on my mission and was just excited about learning and studying and growing.
And so overall, it sounds like you had a somewhat, in some ways, disturbing, challenging, but also a spiritually fulfilling mission. Is that how you'd characterize it?
Yeah, my mission experience, on balance, was very maturing for me. I was spared much of the nightmare. No one knows for sure, but it is estimated that somewhere between 50 and 75% of the missionaries who served in the first part of my mission went inactive when they got home. The mission president that followed the first one was a very kind, very spiritual, caring person, and he turned that whole thing around. So I made the assumption that this was an aberration in Mormon missions and just chalked it up to that and pressed on. What saved me was being unwilling to participate in immoral or unethical activities and being banished to little towns out in the interior.
Okay, and so why don't you bring us forward then to your post-mission life?
My mother moved to Florida from California. I moved with her. I moved in with her in Tampa, Florida. I worked and went to the University of South Florida, got my bachelor's degree, then went up to the University of Florida for a master's degree. I actually went to the University of Florida because I had been given an opportunity to teach evening Institute of Religion classes. When I was at the University of South Florida, I was involved as the LDSSA student leader on campus. And the CES administrator in that area had recommended me as – they were actually looking for a graduate student to teach evening classes at the Institute of the University of Florida. And so that turned out to be a great situation for me. I could work on my master's degree, teach Institute in the evenings, and at that point I was dreaming about being an Institute instructor.
And did you say what your degrees were in, your bachelor's and master's?
They were in educational psychology.
Okay.
Now, I will say once I was not married at that point. I was 20, 25, 26, and I spent a ton of time taking graduate religion and philosophy classes at the University of Florida just for fun.
And so when did marriage come into the picture for you?
What happened is after I graduated, I was moved to Auburn University to be the Institute of Religion director there. And at that point, I was the only single Institute of Religion director in the system, which made some uncomfortable. So there was a bit of pressure to get married. Ultimately was invited to do a workshop at a large single adult activity in Atlanta, Georgia. And I did a workshop on prayer. This was, if you remember, single adults in those days, I guess that would be 1977. Nope. Yeah, about 1977. It was young single adults. So these were unmarried or divorced Latter-day Saints over the age of 26. So that was the group. And my wife had been previously married, had three children. She came to my workshop. I met her afterward at the dance. We had a wonderful evening, and I started driving from Auburn to Atlanta, Georgia every weekend. We dated for, I can't remember now, just really about 4 or 5 months, and married, and then she moved over with the children to Auburn University, where we started our family.
And I know from reading one of your essays that was published in Sunstone Magazine, by the name of Mormon Mantras. I know that you published your experience eventually getting to work for the church education system and serving as a chaplain in the U.S. Air Force for 20 years. Why don't you summarize that for us as well?
Well, I served as the institute director at Auburn University. I was then moved to Atlanta, Georgia, where I supervised early morning and home study seminary in a large area. Was moved a couple of years later to the University of Georgia. I was the institute director there, did seminary supervision also for the in the state. And then in 1984, there was just a confluence of circumstances that brought up this chaplain opportunity. The church has a very hard time finding qualified people to serve on active duty as a military chaplain. Because we don't have religion and theology degrees, our it's hard to find LDS guys, number one, who want to work in an interfaith environment, number two, who are qualified to do so. As it turns out, all of those graduate religion classes that I had taken for fun at the University of Florida, they actually ended up giving me enough hours to qualify for the chaplain service. And so I was recruited with some vigor to resign my job at the Institute of Religion at the University of Georgia and serve as an active duty chaplain, because if the church couldn't fill that spot in so many weeks, another church would get it. It solved a lot of problems for us. It allowed us to get off a river that was causing a lot of mold in our house and aggravating my wife's allergies. It allowed us to sell the house and pay off some debts. And so it just seemed like a good thing to do. Plus, as the institute director, I actually had involved our students in a number of interfaith activities around the campus with the other religious student centers. And I think the church saw me as someone who would work effectively in an interfaith environment. So it just seemed to be a good move for all involved. And of course, as a military chaplain, which I did a full career of a little over 20 years, you work in an interfaith environment. I did Protestant or general Christian worship services, weddings, funerals, Sunday schools, marriage retreats. Chaplains do tons of personal counseling, marriage counseling, in addition to the military responsibilities and activities. So it's quite an interesting job with a lot of variety.
So as a chaplain, let me make sure I understand that correctly. As an LDS chaplain, it sounds like your duties went beyond ministering just to Latter-day Saints, but included members of other faiths as well. Is that right?
That's correct. The chaplain service really saw chaplains divided into Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, and then later Muslim. So the LDS chaplains really served in the Protestant category, and probably only 1% of my work had anything to do with Latter-day Saints.
Okay, interesting. And so would you be leading weekly Protestant services on Sundays?
Absolutely.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about that, because that sounds a little unusual to have an LDS member leading Protestant services. I mean, were these services the same services that would have been attended by LDS servicemen as well?
No, the church expected LDS members to go to the local ward off base.
Okay.
So I'm actually leading a general Christian or a general Protestant service. We would have different flavors of services. They would be like a typical Baptist service or Methodist service. Lutheran Episcopalian chaplains would do more of a high church sort of service. There was a fair amount of controversy. Many of the very conservative Christian chaplains felt it was inappropriate for Mormons to be leading worship. In some cases, our chaplains would be banned from leading worship. It all depended on the supervising chaplain. Sometimes people in the congregations would be upset and threaten to leave if the Mormon led the service. Sometimes there were no problems whatsoever. So that's a whole big story in and of itself.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting just because I've never heard of anyone in this role, and so it's interesting to me anyway. Can you tell us, I'm just curious, when you were holding your Protestant services, did you experience what you would call spiritual experiences? Would you feel the Spirit leading a Protestant meeting or participating in a Protestant meeting?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I was certainly restricted to teaching only from the Bible. But anytime you're studying the scriptures, you're trying to prepare a message that you believe is going to nourish other people's souls, and you're doing it prayerfully and you're teaching it with conviction, that's going to be a spiritual experience. And And I just began to discover so many wonderful people who came from a variety of religious backgrounds, that it was enjoyable, it was spiritual. And for a Mormon who in some ways expected less, I guess, spiritual development out of Baptists and Methodists, I ran across many folks that I felt were Christ-like in very rich ways, and I admired these folks. And I actually spent some time intentionally interviewing people, trying to figure out what it was about them that enabled them to develop what I was witnessing as genuine Christ-like qualities. And as I would talk with these folks, what became clear to me was it didn't have anything to do with them being a Methodist or a Baptist or a Catholic. They were just qualities that had developed within these people as individuals, and their church seemed to be irrelevant.
So it sounds like by growing up Catholic, then becoming LDS, then leading Protestant worship services, it sounds like a lot of these barriers or these walls, these very strict defining boundaries between religions or churches really started to melt for you. Would you characterize it that way? In other words, that you didn't see, well, I'll just give you an example. I wager to guess that there would be some Latter-day Saints who would have a very hard time leading Protestant worship services as not feeling some sort of, being pricked in their conscience about whether that's the right thing to do. But it seems to you that through this experience working as a chaplain, that these sorts of religious boundaries didn't really matter to you as much as they might to other folks.
Well, no. And frankly, you know, the role of a chaplain is to be of service in the broadest possible way without an agenda. I mean, the church has military chaplains to be a positive influence, to serve others, but there's also a sub-agenda of public relations work, of people being exposed to Latter-day Saints and seeing them in a positive light. So I know the church sees a lot of that service as indirect missionary work. We were forbidden from doing any direct missionary work because it compromises the purpose of the chaplain service. So to be in an environment where really your focus is just to help people live their lives productively and spiritually and to help develop their and nurture their spiritual growth is a great place. It's a great environment.
And so your role as a chaplain really demanded that you have an open-mindedness. It sounds like you were already a very open-minded person from the get-go, having gone and investigated, every possible church religion you could find when you were 17, 18, 19. It seems like this would just further open and broaden your mind and your heart to all different faiths and people of all faiths.
It did. Now, I did, for the first, 15 years of my military chaplain career, I did always believe that Mormonism was superior, that our doctrine was better. Our lifestyle and adherence to what we believed was superior to what others were doing in general. Again, I would see these individuals exhibit spiritual development that I wasn't necessarily seeing in myself or other church members, but on a whole, because of what I was seeing going on with other ministers and priests, I was still convinced, at least 15 years into my service as a chaplain, that what we were doing was obviously superior because the church was true.
Okay. And this is probably an appropriate place to segue to something you brought up in your essay entitled Mormon Mantras. And by the way, I think it would it'd be great if, I think we'll try to put a link up on the Mormon Stories website so people can read your essays. But I remember reading in your Mormon Mantras essay that everything was going along very well in your work as a chaplain. You were enjoying it. You were having these wonderful experiences with people of different faiths. But that inside there was this sort of nagging dissatisfaction or this inner turmoil. And why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, several things began to happen. Anytime, because I'd had special training in marriage counseling, anytime I would be stationed in an area, the local bishops would tend to send me the couples in the wards that were in need of marriage counseling. Most bishops are too busy and most haven't been trained in marriage counseling, so to have someone like me in the area was very attractive. And so I began spending a lot of time counseling with LDS couples. And at first, I would try to incorporate gospel principles into my marriage counseling, thinking that, you know, this is what's going to help more than anything else. And I was a bit dismayed to find out that gospel living really was not empowering couples to overcome the core issues in their marital difficulties, which were a reflection of their own personal issues and problems. In many cases, I would just have to give that up entirely and default to standard sorts of communication, conflict resolution, effective communication techniques, and so forth. And that began to bother me. That began to disturb me that I wasn't seeing the gospel bearing fruit at the core of people's difficulties and problems. Of course, it's easy to see this stuff outside yourself more clearly than to see it inside yourself. At some point, I began to be aware of my wife's accurate observations that there were things about me that really needed to be changed. And as I sat back and reflected on that, I realized that many of the Christ-like qualities I had always desired and prayed for and worked for just were not evident. And that did have an impact in our family. I think my wife expected better, as she should have. And as I began to reflect on that, I was a little troubled because in my case, everything I did was involved in religion or spirituality or spiritual growth, whether I was working as an institute teacher or as a military chaplain. You know, I had the time and the facility and the opportunity to be immersed in reading, studying, praying, growing, learning, much more so than that someone who works a full-time job and then, you know, does their personal spiritual disciplines as they can. And I just kind of came to the conclusion that, gosh, if this isn't working for me at the core level, what's the problem? It just began to create some discomfort and doubts and concerns.
Okay. And why don't you bring us up to the point then when you had a very serious bout with some chronic physical pain.
In July of 1999, I had an accident where I injured my neck, my left shoulder, and my back. The shoulder pain was the shoulder injury was the most obvious because it was so painful, and it took about 8 to 10 months of treatment to rehab that shoulder. What I didn't realize at the time was that my neck and back had been injured in ways that were progressive in nature, and it took about a year for those symptoms to manifest. And so at about toward the end of the summer of 2000, I began to have a cascade of pain horrible pain patterns, dizziness, just a load of problems that came out of the blue. I went to the doctors several times. I began to have pains in my chest that felt like a heart attack. They diagnosed me as someone having an anxiety disorder, which made no sense to me. And pretty soon, after months and months of chronic pain, what happens is your nervous system does get burnt out, and then you start manifesting stress symptoms, anxiety symptoms. Anxiety over a long period of time ultimately is going to turn over to depression, and it just didn't take very long before I was a mess.
And so what did you do to try to solve this? I mean, you mentioned going to a doctor and getting misdiagnosed as having an anxiety disorder. Anything else that you reached out to or turned to try to overcome this physical and what was now mental and emotional pain?
Yeah, because I wasn't getting any medical support, I approached it from a spiritual perspective. I began to study and fast and pray. Everyone who knew me and loved me blessed me. My son gave me a blessing. My bishop blessed me. My stake president blessed me. I began studying about healing, and then, you know, you start to do things superstitiously. You pray more, thinking that if I prayed 10 minutes more, maybe God will take mercy on me and heal me. And I just did everything in my knowledge to be able to find relief or to be blessed in some way. And I actually just continued to get worse and worse. Probably at a point of what I would call collapse. I was over a year and a half into this with no relief. And I picked up a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn called Full Catastrophe Living. It's actually a book about he was the director of the Stress Reduction Pain Management Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And the book was his program for managing chronic pain and stress. And it was a program that was built on Buddhist meditation principles, simple yoga practice, and some body work, body energy, body awareness and body energy work. And it was a book I'd actually had for 10 years, but it just sat on my shelf. I hadn't really been motivated to get into it. That was kind of my last-ditch effort. So from that book, I read about stress and pain as he explained it. I began practicing the meditation techniques as he explained. I started doing simple yoga and the other body work that is recommended in his program. And it was very difficult at first. First 2 weeks, I didn't have the success that I thought I would have, but I didn't have anything else, and I just stuck with it. And then I began to notice, after a few more weeks, that during the period of time in which I was meditating, I did not have the symptoms. I didn't have the dizziness. I didn't have the pain. I didn't have anxiety. There was just calmness and an absence of those symptoms. Well, that being the case, it really motivated me to continue the meditation practice. And in hindsight, I mean, as a meditation instructor now, it's hard for me to encourage people to get through the initial 2 to 4 to 6 weeks of just work involved in learning how to establish yourself in meditation, where you can start receiving the benefits so it becomes self-motivating. Most people try it for a few weeks. They don't get the results they want, and they quit. What dawned on me was I had this guru of pain and stress always lurking over me, so to speak. And frankly, if you're only going to get relief from pain and distress during meditation, you're going to spend a lot of time in meditation. So I ended up logging a lot of hours in meditation and meditative yoga. And what dawned on me at one point was, wow, if I can be free from these symptoms, let's say for 20 minutes or for an hour, why can't I be free from them for 2 hours or 3 hours or half a day? I mean, it was something that gave me a tremendous amount of hope.
Okay. And why don't you tell us then about, I don't want to go into the mechanics of meditation just yet. I want to cover that a little bit more in depth now, but I just want to kind of wrap up the sort of background story before we take a deeper dive into meditation and Eastern thought in general. But did you have any other main books you read or sources you turned to that introduced you to the practice of meditation or yoga or other Eastern spiritual paths?
Yeah, what happened was I providentially ran across a Deepak Chopra audio program called Training the Mind, Healing the Body. That program was so hopeful and inspiring to me. I began attending meditation and other types of seminars at the Chopra Center. And I ended up adopting his particular style of meditation called primordial sound meditation, which is a yogic form of meditation. So I switched from kind of a Buddhist mindfulness type of meditation that Jon Kabat-Zinn uses in his program and rooted myself deeply in a classic yoga form of meditation. And it was soon after doing that that I began to notice other things happening other than just symptom relief. What I began to notice was that when I would do my scripture reading in the morning, my understanding of the scriptures, the inspiration that came to me from the scriptures was greatly enhanced. I began having spiritual perceptions that I hadn't had before. My prayers suddenly began to be much more richer and more meaningful, in some cases almost poetic, which certainly wouldn't be descriptive of my personality. And at some point I realized that this meditative path was not primarily about stress reduction and pain management, but that it really was a spiritual path. And it was that motivated me to start to begin really an in-depth study of meditation. Where did it come from? What's the philosophy undergirding it? And for the first 5 years, it was pretty much done in the context of the teachings of Chopra and others of that in the yoga tradition. I actually trained to become one of his meditation instructors. I ultimately ran into some conflict with business practices and the way the system was being run at that time. And he actually left. He moved on to do other things and left others to take over the day-to-day business of the center. He personally was very helpful to me in establishing my meditation practice. And after he was gone, it just didn't seem to be the right place for me. So I ended up training with a group in Florida for certification, started teaching meditation on my own at that point. And then in the last 5 years, I've come under the tutelage of a gentleman named Roy Davis, who is a direct disciple of the famous yogi Yogananda, who came over to America in 1920 from India. And he's currently my meditation teacher.
Okay, and I'm intrigued by this quote that you have in your Mormon Mantras essay. You summarized your meditation practice like this. You said, "After 3.5 years of meditation, I experienced the realization that without the goal setting or other conscious self-improvement efforts I'd tried in the past, I had become much less defensive, selfish, impatient, and judgmental. I had also become far more emotionally vulnerable, open, and honest. The positive spiritual qualities I had worked at, mostly unsuccessfully, for 30 years, were now simply unfolding." Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Can you expand on that just a bit?
Well, during this physical crisis, the threat that I was facing was if I couldn't do my military job, I'd be medically retired and not have a full retirement, which we really needed for the stability of our family. So in those early, those first 3 years when I was learning to meditate, the goal really was to manage the symptoms, to be able to get to work and to do a good job so that I could ultimately be able to retire from the military. And I had no, other than that, I really didn't have any definitive spiritual goals. Now, you can tell from that list you read, those were my wife's complaints. That I could be sarcastic, I could be judgmental, I could be rude, I could be impatient, I could be emotionally withdrawn. I mean, those were the things that she did not want in our relationship. She wanted Christ-like qualities. She wanted honesty. She wanted openness. She wanted affection. She wanted, you know, those things you would desire in an ideal relationship. And the sad thing is that at that point, after 30 years of living Mormonism as richly as I could, those spiritual qualities had really not become a reality. And I would do things, and you know, if she would say to me, "You need to be more patient," I would set a patience goal. I would go to the temple. I would fast. I would pray. And there would be these small improvements, but you know, they really weren't the things that should have been happening for someone who was desiring to exhibit patience with their family. And so here I go through this 3-year period where I'm just trying to survive and do my job. I'm not trying to necessarily become Christ-like, although I am recognizing there's something going on with me spiritually in a new way. And we just had a day of recognition. My wife was walking through the room. She stopped and sat down in front of me, and she said, "You know, you're different." And I said, "What do you mean?" And then she went through this list that you just read. You're not sarcastic and rude the way you used to be. You're not controlling. You're not judgmental. You're not critical. You're emotionally vulnerable and open. And you know, the question for both of us was, whoops, when did this happen and how did this happen? Because it really wasn't intentional.
Okay, and so for all of our wives who are listening and desiring the same results for their husbands, what are the best books that, or the best resources that you can point them to learn about meditative practice?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. Give me some time to think about that. It's hard to recommend books not knowing where people are.
Sure.
I have a variety of books I recommend when I get to know somebody, when I have a sense for where their beliefs are, what works for them. The meditation book market's very confusing. There are many different styles, many different systems. Yeah, and it's very easy for people to pick up 2 or 3 books, find contradictory things, get discouraged, and just throw the whole thing up in the air.
Okay, maybe what we'll do then is in this next major segment of the interview where we go more into the mechanics of meditation, the how-to, we can lay some background and distinguish between the various traditions and different ways of practice. And then you can think about it after this interview is concluded. And if you have any main recommendations or anything like that, we can always put links up on the Mormon Stories website for people to refer to.
Yeah, and see, books that were meaningful to me don't necessarily have that same impact on others.
Sure.
Deepak Chopra's Seven Spiritual Laws of Success was foundational for me. His book Power, Freedom, and Grace was foundational. Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now was significant as far as getting my mind thinking in a metaphysical way. Meditation instruction was actually done personally. I mean, I received personal instruction, even though I had learned stuff from a book initially. And that's the most effective way, is from an instructor that knows what they're doing. And I've actually developed my own sort of system for teaching meditation. So Meditation for Dummies is not a bad book. It's more in a Buddhist style. I'm kind of in the yogic style, but there's a tremendous amount of wonderful information in that book. So I'll think of some others as we move along.
Okay. And so you summarize in your Mormon Mantras essay that with a combination of meditation, yoga, and medical treatment, you eventually became 90% symptom-free. And is that where you are today?
Yeah. What happened was they finally looked at me a little more closely, and I had injuries to my spine that were causing the pain patterns that mimicked heart attack. So there was actually something going on, just not anxiety. I was able to start a yoga program that was designed to help my back. Anti-inflammatories helped, and some other things, some physical therapy. So this whole program I put together, I still have the same problems. In some respects, they've gotten worse, but I'm pretty much symptom-free 90 to 95% of the time.
Okay, and I'd like to circle back to something you raised, which was that you were really struck by how you were able to accomplish the results that basically you were able to accomplish with over 3 years of meditation, something that you had not been able to accomplish through 30 years of Mormonism. And I'm imagining that there had to be moments when you realized that and you tried to make sense of that you found in meditation and in these Eastern paths the means to accomplish the goals that Mormonism had helped you set. And could you explain to us a little bit of what your thoughts were about that, or how you reconciled that, if you were able to?
Yeah. What dawned on me as I sat back and tried to imagine how this had happened, what I began to realize was that meditation, properly understood and properly practiced, is really the essence of true prayer. Most people's prayers are mental exercises. They're extensions of their ego, trying to work out needs and problems with their lives, looking for supernatural help. They tend not to be spirit-to-spirit communion with the divine or with God. And what dawned on me is the way that I was practicing meditation, I had a settled body, I had a settled mind, and it had evolved into truly a spirit-to-spirit communication. And when you spend time in the presence of pure spirit, when you spend time in the presence of God, what naturally happens is those things within you that are contrary to His character and nature, and frankly contrary to the essence of your own inner being, those things begin to weaken and dissolve and break up and to fade away. And the things that are in harmony with the nature and character of God, which are also in harmony and nature with the character of your inner essence of being, those things are nourished and strengthened and just begin to naturally unfold. So it's just a very natural process of divine nature awakening and unfolding, and things that are ungodly losing their strength and fading away. There's a purification of the subconscious mind that takes place over years of meditation, and what unfolds is Christ-like nature, divine nature.
And did you ever find yourself wondering, see, I'm trying to figure out who the prophet would have been. I guess it would have been President Hinckley. Did you ever find yourself wondering, well, why, if this is true, if this is good, if this helps me develop Christ-like qualities, why am I not hearing about this at General Conference? Why are there not less gospel doctrine and gospel principles, lessons dedicated to this? Why is this something that I basically had to go outside of Mormonism to discover in order to help me accomplish the goals that Mormonism had helped me set?
Yeah, I'm actually challenged with that question in my meditation seminars quite regularly by LDS folks. It did create a crisis for me. I did sit down one day and I thought, wow, I did 30 years of Mormonism seriously, full time. I mean, by desire, and it is my work. And I mean, I have to say, you know, Mormonism took a confused, not sure what to do with his life, 19-year-old boy and put him on a mature, stable life path. I mean, at that point in my life, Mormonism was saving because of the tremendous improvement that, you know, resulted from age 19 to, say, age 25. But what wasn't happening was this inner spiritual rebirth, this inner spiritual transformation. And for me to literally in 3 years experience all the goals that I had set, that I imagined was possible from a Mormon point of view, to just happen from 3 years of meditation, I then had to sit back and ask myself the question, who am I? Am I a Mormon guy or am I a yogi guy? And it did present a bit of a crisis for a year or so.
And so when you say it was a crisis for a year or so, I guess that means you did finally come to resolve it. If so, how?
Well, the resolution, as a matter of fact, the article I wrote, The Yoga of Christ, came out of that resolution. By this time, I had retired from the Air Force. I was working as a hospice chaplain, as I am now. And during all of my free time, I'm doing yogic spiritual disciplines, meditation, yoga, and other things. I'm reading ancient yoga scriptures. I'm reading the teachings of ancient and modern day yogis. I mean, that's my study and reading. But during the daytime, I was reading from the New Testament to my hospice patients, because they're almost all either Latter-day Saint or Christian. So I had these two things happening at the same time. And the moment of illumination was when I was reading in Matthew chapter 11, where Jesus says, you know, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. I haven't got it in front of me to read, but, and I will give you rest. Learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. Take my yoke upon you, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You will find rest unto your souls. Well, I knew from my yoga studies that word yoke comes from the Sanskrit word yug, which is also the same word that the word yoga comes from. And in my mind, I translated this as Jesus saying, practice my yoga and your burden will be light and you'll find rest under your souls. And really, in almost immediately, the New Testament was transformed for me. All of the stories, the parables, the teachings of Jesus all of a sudden took on a richness and a deep significance that I had never seen before. I saw the core meaning of these teachings to be in harmony with what I was studying in yoga philosophy and in the yogic scriptures. And I realized at that moment that the teachings of Jesus are richer and deeper than I had ever imagined, that they're at the core level, there's really no conflict here, and that I can be a disciple of Jesus, I can be a follower of Jesus, and not have to lose or give up any of what might be considered to be the Eastern spiritual practices that I had adopted. So it just all came together for me at that moment. And so this whole idea of yoga of Christ is really symbolizes this reconciliation of both sides of that for me.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonstories.org. To keep the podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Stories logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. Nearer, my God, to thee. Nearer.